Listen online or download from the RN website.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. Nice to be with you this morning for Books and Arts Daily. Today, John Safran joins us to talk true crime with Victoria Redstall, who writes about serial killers.
My goal was to meet this guy face to face and see if I could win him over enough to do a documentary on him or a book or a story or a film. So there was something. I had to do this story.
That's later in the show. And two stories about being black in white Australia. Later, playwright Daniel Keane with his tough new play about a black man who finds love amid the racism of a very white Australia. And we start with the Aboriginal painter who taught white Australians to see.
Oh, the stairs that Namatjira climbed up to the Hall of Fame. And there he left upon its walls a true Australian name. His paintings out of God's own country where its people claim. The stairs that Namatjira climbed up to the Hall of Fame.
Namatjira, yes, sung there by Slim Dusty, of course. Namatjira's name is, I guess, forever associated with those vivid watercolours of Central Australia, particularly of the McDonnell Ranges. Now, he learnt the art of watercolour from a white artist whose name was Reginald Batterby. Batterby was from Warrnambool, which is in coastal Victoria. The writer, Martin Edmonds, has written a dual biography of these two artists, and he joins us now. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael.
Nice to have you here. So your book is called Batterby and Namatjira, which is a very fine title.
Thank you.
What we're doing. So I guess most of us know about Albert Namatjira, every Australian would, but who was Reginald? Who was Rex Batterby?
Yeah, Reginald was his birth name, but he was usually called Rex. He was he was the youngest of five children, born in Warrnambool, as you said, the son of a pig farmer. And he probably would have been the one of the children to take over the family farm, but he enlisted and went off to the First World War and was very badly shot up. In fact, he was left for dead. And following that, there was a long period of hospitalisation, and he wasn't really fit to go back on the land, so he elected to become a painter instead.
So he trained as a commercial artist originally, didn't he? And he always wore a sock, you say, over his maimed hand. This is when he was painting, was it?
Yeah, for the rest of his life, he had to have skin grafts onto one of his hands, his left hand, not his painting hand. So he would wear a protective covering, and yeah, usually a sock. I've seen one of the socks. His daughter still has it.
So what? Oh, it's a sort of family memento.
Yes.
Gosh, how strange. So he moved to Alice Springs in 1940, I think it was. What took him there?
Well, he and his painting partner, John Gardner, in 1928 started taking these long inland painting trips. They go up to Queensland and Western New South Wales, South Australia, and they kind of went every 2 years, painted and took the work back to Melbourne and sold it. But they arrived at this idea that Alice Springs was a kind of mecca, and they wanted to get there. They used to drive in an old Model T Ford ambulance that had been converted. They finally got to Alice Springs in 1932, and from there went out to the Hermannsburg Mission, returned again in 1934, and then in 1936, Rex went back by himself, and that was specifically to give painting lessons to this young Western Arunta man called Albert.
So he meets Albert Namatjira there on the mission. This is where Namatjira lives. And as you say, he's an Arunta man, which is one of the big tribes of Central Australia. What sort of place was Hermannsburg?
Well, Hermannsburg was a Lutheran mission. It had been founded back in the 19th century and then kind of abandoned and then resuscitated in the 1890s under a man called Carl Strello. It was effectively a cattle station. They farmed stock and attempted to run the mission as a commercial proposition, you know, as a farm. But it was also supported by government funding, and it was about supporting the Arunta people who were at that point being kind of moved off their traditional lands. Mm.
So just describe this meeting, will you? I mean, here's this painter arrives at the mission, and there's the young Namajira. Is Namajira already painting?
No, at that point, 1934 is the crucial date, probably. In 1934, Batterby and Gardner held an exhibition at Hermannsburg, and against precedent, the then pastor, Pastor Albrecht, decided that the native people would be allowed to look at this work as well. Usually, previously, only the white staff had been invited in. And Albert was one of those who saw the work, and he said to Pastor Albrecht afterwards, "I think I can do this." But at that point, he was a souvenir maker. It was a form of, they called it poker work. It was basically burning designs into wood and making wall-hanging plaques.
Which they'd sell to tourists.
They would sell them to tourists. Yeah. And Albert was considered, he was the gun poker work man. He could draw extremely well, and his work sold better than anyone else's.
So what was it about those paintings that spoke to Albert?
Well, I think it was a revelation to not just to Albert, but to all of the people at Hermannsburg and other Aboriginal people elsewhere who saw this work, because it's obviously realist work. It looks like the landscape, and Arunta people didn't have a tradition of realistic art. Their art was symbolic. And I think it was a revelation. They saw on the walls exactly what they saw when they looked out into the landscape surrounding them.
So it would be the same excitement you feel if a photographer comes along and photographs your community, I guess, or a filmmaker comes in and you see the faces of people you know up there on the screen.
Yeah, something's been added to your reality that wasn't there before.
Gosh, that must have been an exciting moment. And those paintings, the paintings that Rex is doing before he starts to collaborate with Albert, do they look like Namajira's? Can you see the style that Namajira was to pick up in those early paintings by Rex?
Rex was kind of self-taught as a watercolourist, and his work is eccentric in some respects. But in the sense that he was painting the landscape of the Western MacDonnells, yes, you can see him as a precursor of Albert's work. Rex is an interesting character because he believed that he'd evolved a new method of watercolour painting, which was focused on this word luminosity. And this was the method that he went on to teach to Albert.
And which Albert ended up surpassing him in.
Well, yes, Rex was a successful painter through the 30s and 40s, but he actually spent a great deal of time and energy fostering the Hermannsburg School of watercolour painters, and perhaps to some extent neglected his own work as a consequence. Albert's work, to my mind, even though they share subject matter, they're quite different as painters. Namajira's work is remarkable for its space. He captures space in a way that is extraordinary. That wasn't Rex's. Rex's work is more patterned and more perhaps on the surface. So although the subject matter is, you know, sometimes identical, they look different.
When you look at an Namajira, you do feel this sense of light and life and intimacy in the landscape, and as you say, a sense of spaciousness. And paradoxically, when you look closely at the painting, there's this absolutely tiny little attention to detail as well.
Yes, so you get the very close and the very far away in Albert's work. That's exactly right. And he had a prodigious memory. Lee Robinson, who did some filming with Namajira and Batterby in the 1940s, told a story about how Albert could lock himself away in his house and reproduce in that exquisite detail a landscape that was, you know, 30, 40 kilometres away, and he could do that simply through his extraordinary visual memory.
On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking about Reginald Batterby, or Rex Batterby, who was the artist who taught Albert Namatjira how to paint. The two men are the subject of a new biography, a joint biography, written by Martin Edmund, who's our guest here this morning. So when does the rest of Australia discover this marvellous painter, Namatjira?
Well, they started... Pastor Albrecht and Rex Batterby worked very closely together to launch Albert as an artist, and he started showing in Adelaide. He had his first one-man show in Melbourne in 1938, and it was a sellout. He had another show in Adelaide in 1939, which also sold out. And really, from then on, he showed regularly Adelaide, Melbourne, eventually Sydney, also Perth and Brisbane. They were mostly one-person shows, and they almost invariably sold out. This is through the period of the late 1930s and the 1940s.
Martin, I think people imagine today, or talk today, as if white Australia's sympathy for or interest in Aborigines sort of starts in the 1960s, I guess, perhaps with the referendum. But in the 1930s, there is this extraordinary focus on the desert and this interest in what the desert means. And I think that a lot of white Australians felt that the desert was a kind of affront to colonial ambition. And they were only used to seeing it in magazines like Walkabout, which in that stage were published, at that stage was published in black and white. Yeah. So they always saw the desert as this sort of grainy black and white place that seemed rather sort of nihilistic and grim. And suddenly, there are these visions of the desert as a place that's sort of friendly and joyful and colourful.
Yeah, there were people who, confronted with early Rex Batterby paintings of Central Australia, who couldn't actually believe that he was representing the colour accurately. They thought he was making it up.
Yeah. Well, the fact that the desert itself is red comes as a shock to people who've never seen it. And when you read the early explorers, they don't mention that it's red.
Yeah, that's curious, that, isn't it? But early explorers often talk about great plains of rich pasture land as well, which, of course, turns out to be highly seasonal and related to drought cycles. And someone would go back a few years later and it would be a desert again.
It would be a very different place.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So it wasn't all rosy, was it, between the two of them? There was some tension. Can you talk about what the cause of these tensions were?
Well, I think Albert Namatjira was a man who desired freedom, I mean, as we all do. But he lived as, I mean, he grew up on the mission. He was always beholden as a child and a young man to the rules of the mission, which were benign in some respects but quite harsh in others. By the time he becomes an artist in his own right and begins selling and making a very good living, he's still beholden to the mission. The mission is still attempting to make sure he doesn't spend all the money, that he saves it up until later on. And to some extent, Rex, in those early years, is operating under the authority of the mission as well. So Albert becomes restless under this regime quite early. There's an episode in 1939, I think it was, where they're camping out at Ormiston Gorge and Albert's sons start coming into the camp. And Rex says, well, you can't do this, Albert. I promised Pastor Albrecht that the family wouldn't be along on this trip. So Albert's in this invidious position where he either has to accede to the demands of, you know, this paternalistic regime he lives under, or he has to get rid of his kids. So, tensions like that persisted right throughout his life, and they became much more acute, I think, in the 1950s.
Well, I think the tragic end of Namatjira's life is a well-known story, and we don't need to recap it here. I was watching a video last night on YouTube that said that Namatjira was granted citizenship, but you remind us that that's not actually the case.
Well, no, he's always said to have been the first Aboriginal to be granted Australian citizenship. It's not strictly true. What happened to Albert was that he had his name taken off the register. Now, the register was something that the Northern Territory government kept, and upon it they listed the names of every full-blooded Aboriginal in the Northern Territory. Quite an extraordinary bureaucratic feat, really. And by about the mid-50s, there were something like 15,000 names on that list. Half-castes, so-called, didn't appear upon it, and obviously white people didn't either. Albert's grant of citizenship was effectively just he had his name taken off the register. Both his and his wife Rubina's names were excised from this document, but none of their children's names were. So he was kind of in this position where the law related differently to him and his wife than it did to his children.
Yeah, well, it's a very sobering into a story of a marvellous painter. And look, it's a great topic that you came up with, Batterby and Namajira, to put them together in a book. I mean, it's such an obvious idea. And it just works so well. Thank you for coming in, Martin. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you, Michael.
Martin Edmonds, he's the author of Batterby and Namajira. It's published by Giramondo. This is Books Nuts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Still to come, John Safran shares his love of true crime writing. Music from the 1970s film Ali, Fear Eats the Soul by German director Rainer Werner Fassbinder. Now, two of Australia's leading theatre makers, playwright Daniel Keane and the director Ariet Taylor, have joined forces to bring us a play that's partly inspired by that classic film. It's called Dreamers, and it's a defiant story, really, about a young immigrant man who was hammered with racist abuse because of the colour of his skin and who falls in love with a much older woman, a white Australian widow. Joining me in the studio are the playwright Daniel Keane. Good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Nice to have you here. And the actors who play the man and the woman, Yomal Rajasinghe. Good morning. Nice to have you here. And Helen Morse.
Good morning.
Nice to have all of you aboard. So, Daniel, briefly, I mean, I know the answer to this because I saw it the other night, but share with Australia what this play is all about.
Well, it's about many things, but I think it's mainly about the fear of difference or the fear of change, I think. Because the play is set, it's a small community, a tight community, and into that community comes a stranger and something happens that they're not used to, that seems different, that threatens them, basically. So those angry responses and those violent responses and those hateful responses, I think, are all about people not wanting the boat rocked or their habits changed or what they're used to be any different.
You write in the program, I wish that writing a play like Dreamers wasn't necessary.
Yep. Well, I wish it wasn't. I mean, I wrote the play several years ago, or 4 years ago, 5 years ago, for a company in France, and then the problems that it addresses are the same there as they are here. Perhaps racism, I think, in France is a bit more visible. Here it's opaque and much more deadly because people pretend it doesn't exist.
I didn't actually appreciate that. So it was a French story before it was an Aussie story, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wrote the play for a French company based in Toulouse called Tabula Rasa, and it was performed in France at the National Theatre in Toulouse. But so this is the first time it's been performed in English and the first time I've ever heard it in English, so that was interesting for me.
And how is it different?
Well, it's in English, but the production, of course, is quite different. But it's interesting because the problem with it, I thought, was that it's very French, because I knew it was for a French company, French actors, French audience, and I'd been to France long enough to sort of recognise certain things and put them in the play. But strangely enough, when we started reading it here in Melbourne with Ariet and the actors, there wasn't a lot to change, actually. A few tiny things, but not very much. So the attitudes and the problems in it are quite transferable.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that some more. So it is, as I say, in some sense a response to two movies, actually. Fassbinder's movie, Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, a 74 movie, and then All That Heaven Allows, a Douglas Sirk movie from 1955. Mm. Is that important to understanding the play, or is that just part of the architecture of your imagination?
It's not at all important. The original commission from Tabula Rasa from the director Sebastian Bornack was that did I want to write a play in response to those two movies? So I already knew the movies, and strangely enough, the Fassbinder film is a response to the Douglas Sirk movie, who was a German director who went to Hollywood. So that I watched them again, and it really was, what was distressing was that nothing was any different.
Right.
Like the same sort of racisms and ageisms and, you know, exclusions of outsiders, et cetera, exist now the same way they did when Cirque made the film in 1954. So that was one of the disappointing things about people haven't changed. These problems are still here.
So Ellen Morse, you play Anna in the show. Tell us about her.
Yes. She's a widow. She's a grandmother. She has a daughter who appears in the play as well, Carol, played by Bridget Gallagher. And she is a seamstress. She takes consignments of all sorts of different things, skirts, shirts.
So she's a pieceworker in her own apartment, really.
Yes, basically, yes. She works from home, yes.
Yeah. So it's a kind of complicated relationship she has with her daughter.
It is. It's interesting. I had a conversation with the designer, Adie Chisholm, and I was using the word dysfunctional about the relationship, and Adie said, no, it's more that she's distracted. And I thought, I like that. I like
Who's
that
distracted?
Anna. And also Carol, the daughter. There's a sort of – they're distracted by – they're different worlds, they're different lives.
They're also distracted, actually, because everyone in this play, Daniel, is working very, very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually, one of the themes of the play is that we're taught that jobs are what gives meaning to life, but these are people whose lives are being robbed of meaning by the fact that they have to trudge off every day and work for the man.
Yeah, I think that it's – I've always written about that kind of thing. It just keeps turning up in my work all the time. But, yeah, that labour is important to people. Well, when I've written plays where people lose their jobs, and when they lose their job, they lose themselves. This idea of the self being so tied up with your labour. These people in this play are all hard workers, and they're all probably doing jobs that they don't particularly like. So what does that mean about how they feel about themselves?
Pretty early on, there's a scene which I really liked where three people are sitting on a bus stop and they actually discuss the nature of work. They have a sort of philosophical discussion while they wait for the bus about pay and work and whether or not they expect to find their jobs satisfying. Mm. What's the issue in that scene?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of philosophical discussions take place on that bus stop in the play. But I've always found that to be true. The conversations you have at bus stops and tram stops and on train stations are always pretty interesting.
Well, see, I've never discussed the theory of surplus value, which essentially is what they're doing.
Yes, exactly.
On a bus stop.
Yeah, well, someone's got marks in their bag. But you know, because I don't drive a car, so I've always used public transport. So some of my most interesting conversations have been on bus stops. They mightn't be about Marxist theory, but they have been interesting. But I think that the reason that work comes up so much in this particular play is all about the value of a human being. How are you valued? What do you measure your value by? How do other people see you, and how do they see your value? So the idea of labour or your work is part of how you value yourself and how society values you. So those discussions around work are very important in central to the play, the whole idea of the value of a human being.
Mm. I'm reminded as we talk that it was the Italian Marxist Gramsci who said that all men, he should have said all men and women, are philosophers. You know, so that's borne out by that. Now, Yomal, you're Majid.
Yeah.
What sort of person is he? Come a bit closer. I love that microphone. That's the way.
Yeah, Majid is he's from a different country. He's coming to Australia and trying to start his new life. Then all the other things he has to face, this racism, and then it is very hard for him to find a job. And all the other...
So his first job is he goes to a building site to get a labouring job.
Yeah.
And there's a racist bastard there, basically. He says, well, you know, I'll have to try you out.
Yeah.
And you say, you're going to pay me. He said, oh, well, you know, if we keep you on, we'll pay you. But and we all know, in the audience, we all know he's just going to use you for the day and then throw you away. We know that's going to happen.
Yeah, so that's what's happened. So then in the same time, then Majid goes to the bus stop and then met Anna, and then the relationship slowly started. And, so it would be good. Like, have you seen the theatre piece?
Yes, I've seen the theatre piece. Don't embarrass me on national radio. I look as though I hadn't done my homework, but fortunately, the answer is yes. Yes. So the two of you, the young migrant and the older, with respect.
That's all right.
Helen.
I can handle it. It's true.
lady who's working as a seamstress, get together and have this relationship. They jump into bed together. And this scandalises the labour, you know, the other people in the building. Because, well, it's just inappropriate, Helen.
That's a word, I think, that is in the text.
Well, there you are, tucked up in bed with this very spunky black-skinned man.
Yes. Yes. It's. I think what I like very much about the way Daniel has explored the relationship is that it starts with conversation. And that continues. And the intimacy comes out of a conversation, which I think is a lovely, tender thing that Daniel has written.
Let's hear some of that conversation in action. They're going to do a scene for us. What's the scene, Daniel?
The scene is, this is the second meeting between Majid and Anna. They've met on the bus stop and become sort of acquainted. And this is another day. And Majid is walking along and he walks past the cafe. He gets into a bit of a to-do with the waiter, but that happens before this. Anna sees him and calls him over as if she was expecting him, but of course she wasn't. It was quite a surprise. So he sits down with her. They order a coffee and a chinotto, and they have this conversation.
I was up at dawn today. I had so much work to do. Then I decided I was going to take a break. Then I decided I was going to do whatever I wanted to today, just for a change. So far, I quite like it.
I was walking past, and I saw you. I remembered you from the bus stop. I like what you said about every man's labour being worth something.
Well, it is.
But some men's labour worth more than others.
Some men are paid more than others. That's not the same thing.
How is it the same thing?
What a man is paid isn't always a true measure of the value of his work. Mm. You'll have to get that jacket dry cleaned.
I tried to clean it with a damp cloth, but I think I made it worse. It's the only jacket I have.
I hope you don't mind, but I think I have one that would fit you. It belonged to my husband. Don't know why I've kept it, really. He's been gone for years.
Where did he go?
I mean, he died years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant that he had gone somewhere.
Well, he did go to the cemetery.
You said you have a daughter?
She lives on the other side of the city.
Does she visit you often?
When she needs something. She doesn't need very much very often.
My father is alone now. I have a letter to post to him. I was on my way to the post office when I realized that I left my wallet at home. I decided to just keep walking. I like walking in this city.
How much is the stamp you need? There's a post office not far from here. It's on my way home.
No, really. I'll buy a stamp tomorrow.
You said your father is alone.
Yes.
Then you must send your letter today. The sooner it gets to him, the better. Even one day can make a difference.
What sort of difference?
All the difference in the world.
I'll pay you back for the stamp.
I expect you to.
But not for the coffee.
Not for the coffee, yeah. Ramal Rajasinghe and Helen Morse performing that scene from Dreamers by Daniel Keane, and all three of us are here in the studio here in Books and Arts Daily this morning. Daniel, let's talk some more about political theatre, because the challenge in political theatre, I guess, is to avoid that sense that you're being didactic or preachy, or that you're presenting a kind of simplified version of life, because all ideologies are simplifications of a more complex reality.
Yeah.
How did you face that challenge? Because you do have to ramp up the... Well, I think you're ramping up the racism. I mean, I think you could say fairly that in Australia there is a conversation between racism and tolerance, and especially we are in Victoria, which is, every time anyone does a survey, the most tolerant state. So a less politically charged play would be looking at the capacity for tolerance. And putting it up against racism. So how did you think that through?
Well, I think that... I suppose what I wanted to achieve with the play was that central to the... Well, I just certainly didn't want it to be didactic in the sense of preaching or anything like that. And I think that the way for me to approach that was to make the relationship, the central relationship between your Majid and Anna, as complex and as real and also as tender as possible. So it felt very real, and it was a quiet, gentle thing, not anything else, but it was quiet and gentle. And that... By doing that and making that central and focusing on that primarily, and then surrounding that with this orbit of other characters. And what I tried to do there was to strip away the veneer of these characters so that it's almost like they immediately say what they might otherwise only think. So just by tearing away the veneer, like you understand what their veneers are, but I take that away. So I just reveal like the inside of them all the time. And it's quite it's not a naturalistic play in it by any means. It's not realistic either. So that by doing that and stripping away the veneer, it becomes quite shocking what they're saying. What they're saying is what a lot of people think but don't say. But by taking away the veneer and just letting that be raw, like really quite naked, I think it becomes quite shocking. And I'm not interested in writing a play that's, you know, some sort of symposium on tolerance. I was interested in revealing the ugliness of racism because it still exists.
And one of the things that's one of the factors that has made this play compelling in that regard is the way in which Aret Taylor has directed it, because she's got very grounded performances out of all the actors. I mean, they've really got their feet on the ground. It's powerful work from all of you. Thank you for all coming in. I've really enjoyed talking to three of you. It's been lovely to have you here. So Daniel Keane's the author of Dreamers. It's currently on show at 45 Downstairs in Melbourne, and Helen Morse and Yomal Rajasinghe are two of the actors who are performing in this very ensemble production. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Now, tell me this. What Aussie film does this tune come from? Daniel Keane, do you know the answer?
Malcolm.
It's the film Malcolm, yes. 4 points to Daniel Keane. It's the 1986 film Malcolm, the film directed by Nadia Tass. She also directed another classic, The Big Steal. So she's a very, very busy woman, is Nadia. She's also much in demand as a theatre director. She recently directed The Flick for Melbourne's Red Stitch Theatre Company. Here she is for Top Shelf, revealing the artworks that move her.
I've directed a lot of plays in my lifetime, and the latest play that I'm doing is called The Flick, and it really has become, at the moment, my favourite play because it really speaks about alienation, it speaks about today's society, and how three relatively young people stuck in a menial job have all these wonderful desires about their lives, but we know that the ones that are stuck in this working class environment have absolutely no option of getting out. The Flick is by Annie Baker, and The Flick won the Pulitzer Prize for 2014. Another play that I find myself gravitating to constantly is Medea by Euripides. I was exposed to this as a very young child because the place that I came from in northern Greece was, we had a summer festival of theatre every year. So at 4 years of age, I had to be dressed up as one of Medea's two sons. And so there I was, one of Medea's two sons, and we were going to be murdered by our mother. It stayed with me, and I found myself over the years trying to understand what this play was about. And now I'm finding so many references to this in our current world. You know, there's something to say about the human condition and the fact that Euripides, that many eons ago, would write about something that happened then, and now it continues to do so today. Would you know my name if I saw you in heaven? There's a song that Eric Clapton sang. This is shortly after he lost his little boy in New York. It's called Tears in Heaven. The first time I heard that song, it just broke me completely, broke me up. And every time I hear it, his voice is just so rich and so, it's full of emotion. It's full of the pathos of what actually happened to him, the pain that he experienced in losing that child. And it just takes me there. So, Tears in Heaven. If you want to make me cry or see me cry, put it on. Burnt by the Sun by Nikita Mikhalkov. Probably, yes, it is. It's one of my favourite films ever. Again, incredibly Chekhovian. He's like a conductor who's who's conducting the performances of his actors so beautifully in this film, and the way they really seemingly talk about nothing, but underneath the nothing is so much about the political and social disposition of that time in the USSR, as it was when he made this film. And now it's different, but maybe not that different. The oppressor is slightly different, but the oppressed remain oppressed. And I had the wonderful pleasure of meeting with Nikita Mikhalkov and talking about a whole lot of things. And I have Russian background on one of my from one of my parents, and we started talking about where my lineage is from and where his lineage is from, and we found that his family knows my family, extended of course, but it was wonderful.
We're going to get a little plate, and we're going to have a cow, some pigs, we're going to have maybe a chicken. Down the flat, we'll have a little field.
Feed the alfalfa for the rabbits.
The rabbits.
And I get the tender rabbit.
And my fifth beautiful piece of work that I absolutely adore is Of Mice and Men by Steinbeck. Steinbeck, oh my God, that novel really takes me right back. I think I was 8 when I first read Steinbeck. And it has stayed with me. The relationship between Lenny and George, the caring relationship by George, and the way Lenny is portrayed, it's so beautifully analysed. The disposition, the condition of that character is just incredible. At the end of the novel, George has to do the unthinkable deed of actually killing Lenny to save him from misery and torture. It brings me to tears yet again. It's a joy. It's not so much a joy to know that this is how some people live. It's more a joy to be able to find all those layers behind the human condition. I think it's just a brilliant novel.
On RN, the fabulous film and theatre director Nadia Tass with her Top Shelf. Next up on Books and Arts, we confront the ethics of true crime with John Safran.
In fact, I set my 14-year-old son on fire the other day. You know, he's seen us and the other guys doing torches, and he said, "Oh, Dad, I want to do a torch for him, 15. I said, "Yep, no worries." And I've got to admit, that was kind of a weird thing, throwing a match at your son, and you know, when he's doused in petrol.
Taking life to the extreme with Australian stunt performers Off Track Saturday at 1.
Wow, that really does sound extreme, doesn't it? Well, let's face an extreme of a different kind, true crime. A true crime writer faces a particular ethical challenge, and that is, how do you write about murderers without glorifying what they've done? Well, the documentary maker and broadcaster John Safran asks this question in his RN series on true crime. Last week here on Books and Arts, you heard his conversation with John Berendt, the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Today, John Safran is talking to Victoria Redstall. She writes about serial killers, but her career began in acting and modelling.
Hi, I'm Victoria Redstall. You've probably seen me on Sunset Beach and many other shows. I have to look my best even when I'm not on camera, but I won't sacrifice my health to get the look I want.
Dear listeners, we have Victoria Redstall, who's the author of Serial Killers Up Close and Very Personal, my death row interviews with the most dangerous men on the planet. Despite her accent, she's actually coming from Los Angeles. How are you, Victoria?
Very well, John. Thank you for having me on the show.
Your backstory, they always put this spin on it, that you're the posh girl from a posh family in the United Kingdom, and then you somehow ended up, you know, on the wrong side of the tracks. imprisoned visiting rooms with these killers in the United States. Is that true?
Well, they say that because Surrey, which is where I'm from, S-U-R-R-E-Y, and Esher in Surrey is known to be an exclusive area. But I think my parents are pretty down to earth. And some of my family members, like my uncle is titled and my aunts are titled. But that's about it. It's not like we're from a hugely blue blood family. We're just, I suppose, well-bred people from the south of England, but nothing too much. I think they exaggerate in the media. I think I'm from a good family. I went to boarding school, and I came here and went to study journalism and broadcasting. And after a family tragedy when I was 11 years old, where we had family friends, very close family friends, that were murdered by a mass murderer, that changed my entire life at that moment.
And what are the details around that?
Well, what happened was we had a family by the name of the Perkins. There were four of them. The kids were a little older than me, but it was like my big brother, my big sister. But the father, Nick Perkins, was a person who was a schoolmaster at a school. He was like my second father. I would take orders from him, and I adored him. So we had holidays in Spain. We would see them back in England. However, this Nick Perkins was the headmaster of a school where there was another teacher that had an obsession with the boy, pupil. This Nick had to say, look, I'm going to have to fire you if you continue with this obsession. And this man continued. And Nick then says, I'm going to fire you. So after doing that, one day went all the way to, I believe it was Hackney, where the boy lived, and shot dead the boy's father and shot the boy. Then he drove all the way to Bishop Stortford, where the Perkins family lived, shot dead Gareth, who was like my big brother, and shot Nick rolling around on the lawn outside. So that had such an impact on me when I was 11 years old that I read articles on bizarre and warped mindsets, that of mass murderers, which progressed into serial killers, starting with Dennis Nilsen.
And so it seems like you're searching out answers. It's a pretty clear story. Often with writers, it's wobbly and muddy and trying to figure out exactly what the instigating incident was, but you don't get much more of a dramatic instigating incident than that, I guess.
No, you don't. And like I would say that's what's driven me, is to really understand how an innocent child can become a monster. Because we're all equal when we're born, but we grow up and that's when things change.
And who was the first prisoner that you managed to get access to? And I guess the other thing, a lot of people with my book, because I got to speak to the killer, and people are just really fascinated by, how do you get to speak to a killer in a prison? Aren't they like locked up and what are the laws and blah? How did you get your first interview with a killer?
My first interview was with a serial killer called Wayne Adam Ford, who was in San Bernardino County Jail. I am very much pro-law enforcement, so I also trained to be LA County Deputy Sheriff. And then they asked me to give up all television, everything on camera, which I couldn't do at the time. So my contacts in law enforcement has carried me throughout.
That's quite an interesting entry point, that actually getting involved in law enforcement. Now, Anne Rule, who's a very famous true crime writer, I think she was involved in law enforcement too.
I didn't know that. I love Anne Rule. I think she's a wonderful author.
She did the Ted Bundy, The Stranger Beside Me. Yeah, so just, I don't know, anyone listening who's thinking of becoming a true crime writer, maybe it's not just going to journalism school, it's going to your local law enforcement. So is it
easy? No, you've got to be connected to law enforcement. You don't just suddenly become connected to law enforcement. I went through background checks. I went through physicals, mentals, written, orals, interviews, everything. So I mean, I had a body of people that had known me since 19 years old in Los Angeles County of the Sheriff's Department. So I gravitated towards law enforcement, as opposed to the people in the industry of acting and modeling, which I was in, where they'd go out partying at weekends. I'd be riding along in a sheriff car, or I'd be up in the sky in that sheriff helicopter covering the crime scenes, arresting the fellow people that would go to my gym in the morning. So that was my love of life, was riding along with the sheriff's department with the hopes that one day I'd be a true LA County sheriff, but continuing my career on camera. Can't quite do both. So what happened was, I was asked to do a show by a production company here in LA that I'd done infomercials for, teeth whitening, ab machines, skin creams. This production company said that they were going to do a series inside the mind of a serial killer, but they didn't know my background. They just knew me as a model and an actress and a host. So they said, I said, oh my God, I have got to be part of it. I want to interview the killer off camera. So they said to me, you go out and find the serial killer and we'll talk about it. That's how I met Wayne Adam Ford, who was my first subject.
Yes.
I don't want to say my first victim because that sounds like I'm being funny. I'm not. I did not want to go on his visiting list because I did not want him to know my name. So I said, well, I'd like to go on a tour of the jail, tour being in quotes. And I went in on a Sunday knowing that the lieutenants and the sergeants aren't around then, because units where serial killers are housed, notorious, famous people like that, are off limits to anybody going there for a tour of the jail. So I went on the Sunday and I said, I want to go to Unit 11 because my goal was to meet this guy face to face and see if I could win him over enough to do a documentary on him or a book or a story or a film. So there was something. I had to do this story because I knew there was a victim that was never identified, and this is the first serial killer I've ever read about that turned himself in. And that was my point, from remorse. So I went after him. I went in for the kill. I met him between the bars, so nothing was recorded. And he said to me, as long as you don't sensationalize me, I will be happy to talk to you and only you. And he's given me his exclusivity.
Isn't it a bit late in the day after you're a serial killer to be kind of saying to someone, don't sensationalize this? Wouldn't it be hard not to sensationalize something as dramatic as that?
Exactly. My plan was to tell his story. How can an innocent little child become a monster? And then how can that monster then turn himself in due to the remorse? So I wanted to just tell a story, and that's where I have so much passion in telling a story.
And so the first time you met him, when you kind of got in there, did the law enforcement people, like, they obviously knew you were in there, like, had to check in, but did they know what your agenda was, the law enforcement community, or not?
One deputy did know my agenda. This one deputy who I kept pushing and pushing, oh, please, can we go to Unit 11? I wanted to see this Wayne Ford. And he was a deputy. So, you know, above him's a sergeant and a lieutenant and then a captain. So scandal broke out and this poor man got into some serious trouble. Such serious trouble, you can't believe it, because it's highly illegal to take any human being to Unit 11. Yeah. And then on top of that, to bring a serial killer out of his cell, which was cell number 13, bring him down the stairs and have him speak to some civilian, because I was a civilian at the time, behind bars with nothing recorded, and the guy was going through trial. So, I mean, this could have caused the state a mistrial, which the defense did go for a few times. That's why I was put on the stand. So a lot of things happened, and it was the cause of what they blamed this poor deputy, who was doing nothing but, you know, being kind to me because I was pushing and pushing and pushing to go to Unit 11. And he comes down the stairs, and, you know, I'm thinking, I'm facing a serial killer. And I was really freaked out. But he came to the bars very, very calm. Except when the deputy turned, he kind of looked into the bars and goes, what's your name? And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is now I am living Silence of the Lambs. And I put on my best American accent and I made up my middle name. I said, my name's Claire. And what's your last name, he said. I said, Smith. I was thinking of what's the most common name. I didn't say Saffron. I didn't say Redstall. I just, you know, I came up with something that's pretty generic. And I said, so, he said, Claire Smith. I said, yeah, my name's Clara Smith. He goes, is that accent Australian or English? I'll never forget. And I didn't want him to know I was English, so I said, well, it's Australian. And I can't do an Australian accent at all. So we said, okay. I said, I was thinking of doing a documentary about you, if that's okay. I'd like to tell your story the way you have it. And he said, okay, as long as you don't sensationalize me. And then from then on, I went into the jail under my middle name, which created scandal because I did not want anybody to know my last name and associate me being a model with a serial killer.
Now, in your book, when you meet Keith Hunter Jespersen, that's the Happy Face Killer, he's a Canadian and you're in a prison visiting room and he actually gets to hug you. Is that right?
Oh, they all do. They can, yeah, because there's a cage you're in, or you're at a picnic table, or you're at a table in the room. Yeah.
Oh, really? So I guess a lot of people would have assumed there's glass or bars between you two.
In a jail, there is. In a jail. But the person goes to a jail first before they go to a prison or before death row.
Now, true crime writers, although we like to think of ourselves as flies on the wall and everything's just happening, we kind of affect the experiment depending on, like, who we are and what our personalities are. And with you being a woman, how do you think that affects the experiment, in so much as, you know, if you're going into a prison, you're in a very male-dominated area? And I'm kind of basing this on with my book, when I was over in Mississippi for 6 months, and in the middle of it, an assistant came over to help me. And as soon as she was there, it sort of like seemed to change the dynamics of everything, because obviously, yeah, you have men who are in very men-heavy environments, and suddenly a woman comes in and they kind of, they're flattered or they want to flirt or things like that. Have you noticed those sorts of things?
I haven't noticed necessarily so much the flirting, but I've noticed them show their softer side. I've noticed that, and then I have a way to get things out of anyone, be it male or female. So there's something about me, because I like to open myself up a little bit to them so that they can feel there's a rapport going, and it's just not a one-sided firing questions like a reporter or a cop would do. So I think that there's a softer side that will come out as opposed to man to man. So in that respect, I think it's done me a service.
Do you get to the bottom of why people do this? I guess with like mass murder and with other crimes, you can tie it down to lots of interesting external influences. Like you might say, oh, you know, that person grew up poor or they grew up under racism or something like that. But with serial killing, it seems so specific and weird. It seems to be things that go on in a person's head.
Yeah, but you know, most serial killers have usually got a lethal cocktail. For example, abuse, abandonment, neglect in the childhood, then later on possibly a brain injury. Not always. It can just be the lethal cocktail of what I've just said. And then a brain injury and then maybe addicted to alcohol or something like that. It's just a combination.
Do you often get feedback from the killers after they've seen what you've written or reported about them?
I do. And then, you know, I never make any false promises. I never say that I'm going to give them anything. I don't give them any monetary compensation. I don't say that I'm going to make them look good. I just say, look, I'm going to say the truth. And if there's something huge they want me to stay away from, then I have honored that. I must say I have honored that. So that's just me with people. I treat them like people, despite their crimes. I can't think about what they did for their crime.
A lot of people I spoke to who were like on the wrong side of the track doing my book, like they'd want, you know, a real small amount of money, which didn't seem like a big deal to me. And should I have not have paid these people, do you think?
You see, everyone's an individual. I personally haven't. But I mean, sometimes I think maybe it would work, especially a career criminal. You were dealing with a career criminal, this guy, because he'd been petty theft and everything. A lot of serial killers have never been arrested in their life. So there are hustlers out there. Your guy might have been a career criminal and all he's after is money. Hey, I'll tell you a story if you give me money. That's just not the way I work. It's not my way. There's nothing wrong with it, but I don't do that.
And on a practical level, how long does it take to sort of, if you write to a killer and for them to get back to you, I'm just thinking if anyone's listening and wants to be a true crime writer, like what are they in for? How long do they have to commit to the process?
You do have to cultivate a rapport. You have to cultivate a relationship with them and not just fire questions. You know, you've got to give and take. And I always send a headshot of myself just so they know who they're talking to. So, you know, you've got killers that won't write back. You've got killers that will deny it. You've got killers that never even receive the letter because their prison is not letting it go through. So really, it's a numbers game. It's all about a percentage. You've got to keep writing after everybody. Go after everyone that you want.
Now, do you ever get feedback from families of the victims or from pro-victim groups or whatever? And are they happy with your writing because they think it's advocacy? Or do you get criticisms also because it's maybe you're romanticizing killers?
Well, I really stay away from romanticizing killers because they are the most despicable people on earth. If you're not killing for self-defense, nobody has a right to kill at all. So I get a lot of good feedback, very little negative feedback, but I do respond to the negative feedback.
John Safran with Victoria Redstall. Her book is called Serial Killers Up Close and Very Personal, and it's published by John Blake. And in the next few weeks, we'll bring you more of John Safran in conversation with some of the true crime writers that he's been talking to for his series. What's your favourite book in that genre? You can tell us on our website, on the Books and Arts website, or of course on Twitter. We're at RN Books and Arts. And of course, if you go along to the website, you can download audio of that story or any of the stories you've heard today or over the last few months, actually. Now, tomorrow we're off to the Art Gallery of Western Australia, where you'll meet three extraordinary business people. They're all corporate high flyers, and they're very passionate about the arts. They're also passionate about getting corporate wealth into the pockets of talented artists and adventurous art companies. So that's Philanthropy and the Arts, a really vibrant panel discussion. It's on the show tomorrow. And we'll also talk to Stefano Carboni, who is the gallery director, the director of the Art Gallery of Western Australia. And he talks very candidly, actually, about the challenges that the Art Gallery has been facing. It's been through some very stormy waters, financially speaking, in the last 12 months. And philanthropy is one of the ways in which he's closing that gap. Actually been very successful in raising corporate money. So we'll talk about that. Now, don't forget the November book in the European Classics Book Club is The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. It's a slow, luscious read, so don't delay. You'll need plenty of time. We're going to discuss that on the final Friday of this month, as we always do in European Classics. Now, we're just coming up to news time, and then it's Bush Telly. Cameron Wilson is in the Kimberley region of Western Australia. In fact, he's in the pearling town of Broome today, the gateway to one of the most beautiful coastlines in the world. But things are tough in Broome at the moment. Tourism is in decline, development has stalled, the real estate market's flattened. So we'll be looking at what the future for Broome is. That's Bush Telly coming up straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.
On Background Briefing, the escalating conflict between animal activists and pig farmers.
For so long, they have relied on no one knowing what they're doing behind closed doors. If you are going to abuse and exploit animals, we will be watching and your name will be associated with that.
If they've gone into one of my sheds, that's a crime. If the police and that can't do their job, there's going to be blood, and I mean it.
You can download this Background Briefing from the RN website.